You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about the DNR's new report that summarizes its work last year to improve water quality around the state. Groundwater pollution has been a growing problem in our state in recent decades. And as you recall, Governor Evers had declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water. So what would you like the state government to do to improve water quality? Is your area dealing with water challenges? What are they? And is your water safe to drink? We're at 800-642-1234. Todd Ames is Assistant Deputy Secretary for Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He was formerly the DNR's Water Division Administrator. Todd, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. Glad to be with you this morning.
So the DNR report focuses on several key areas relating to water quality, and one of the things it looks at is nitrate contamination in groundwater and private wells. What can the DNR do immediately to cut down on nitrate pollution?
We have launched an effort to develop some, under the law, we've got some ability to set what's called targeted performance standards when we find that the general statewide performance standards for water quality are not sufficient. So we have done that and launched this rulemaking effort to look at what sort of additional standards should be required in areas of the state where we have high nitrates, but also highly sensitive or permeable soils. So that is was approved by our Natural Resources Board last month, and we're looking forward to the important work ahead to identify how we can get additional measures in place to protect the citizens of the state.
So it sounds like there's a schedule and process set up now, but what legislation would be needed on this effort?
Well, there's a number of things that we pointed to the legislature's water quality task force hearings. Those took place all last year, following up on the governor's declaration of the year clean drinking water. We were glad the legislature also took a hard look at that, and then the recommendations that we offered to them, we pointed to a number of things that we thought would be really important. One was to fund improved mapping capabilities. It's hard to know where you're going if you don't know where you are, and so having additional mapping capabilities relating to land use, geology, hydrogeology. There's also, in the short term, as we're working on this, it's really important that people have both adequate knowledge as well as adequate resources to deal with challenges with their private well. So we've pointed to that as an important issue to focus on as well. One of the things about when you have nitrate contamination or any kind of contamination in the state of Wisconsin, it's a little different from other states. We have estimates are, we've got about 800,000 homes in the state of Wisconsin that get their drinking water from private wells. And in terms of the number of people that includes, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.7 to 2 million people. That's a really high percentage of residents of the state compared with other states. Because of that, there's an enhanced need to focus on potential challenges you may have if you have one of those private well systems. Those are some of the things that we've been pointing to and highlighting as we move forward on this important set of tasks.
Talking with Todd Ames, the Assistant Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin DNR, we're looking at the new DNR summary report on water quality initiatives. Todd, contamination from lead pipes has been an issue in Wisconsin, specifically in Milwaukee, but straight across the country as well. How is the state planning to address lead pipes?
So we've got, this is also a critically important issue in, once again, in the upper Midwest because of kind of the aging infrastructure in this part of the country. We also have a larger number of these lead service lines. So estimates are whether we have about 200,000 lead service lines across the state, about 130 communities. That no amount of lead is safe. And so the only way to be sure that we've got safety is to get the lead out. Now, that's going to be expensive and it's going to take time. So we have been working with local water utilities to address ways that we can provide them with additional funding to be able to offset some of the costs. There was a program that was very successful along those lines that we did a couple of years ago, and now we're working to get more state and federal funding into that program. But meanwhile, I'm happy to report that a number of communities are making progress. Madison has already removed all of their lead service lines, but at least 10 other Wisconsin communities, including communities like Milwaukee, Green Bay, Manitowoc, Kenosha, among others, are moving ahead each in their own way by adopting ordinances.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Sam is joining us from Door County this morning. Hi, Sam.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I would like to touch on a couple of things. Number one is the distrust with the legislature. Things are going so slowly, it's sinful. And I think we're at a critical time within our water quality, but you're asking us to trust the legislature, who just relaxed everything for the build of Foxconn, which is insanity. And the second thing is, and I apologize if I missed anything because I tuned in late, you talked about permeability within soils. I'm wondering what's being done with those areas, such as my own, that literally have no topsoil. Farm runoff is really significant given the stone that we have underneath our minimal topsoil.
Yeah, Sam.
Martin County locally did something, but Door County is doing almost nothing.
Sam, thanks for the call. Todd, what about farm runoff and the topsoil conditions impacting water?
Well, the caller is right. That is certainly a significant issue. We've actually in their area of the state, we have already have, as I referred to these targeted performance standards for nitrates, we already have targeted performance standards for what's called the Silurian bedrock area of the state, and where you get pathogens can get into the waterways. And basically what that amounts to is these are areas of the state where you've got a very low amount of topsoil before you get to bedrock and in turn groundwater. Those standards are already in place. Full implementation is taking place over the next several years as new permitting requirements come into place. So we've got those standards in place, and now getting them fully implemented and up and running will bring some relief in those areas. But one of the reasons that we put out this report and the governor asked us to do this was we wanted to drive home the point that while 2019 was the year of clean drinking water, we're certainly weren't going to fix it all in one year. We've got a long road ahead. It frankly took us a number of years to get to this place. We've got this significant challenge, and it's going to take a concerted effort over a number of years to get us out of that challenge.
Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Todd Ames, Assistant Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin DNR. Tune into Central Time Monday after 3 for more on this issue. Coming up, the number of international refugees who resettled in Wisconsin leveled off in 2019. We check in on refugee resettlement figures in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're headed to the western part of the state to get an update from our WPR reporter in La Crosse on a number of developing stories, including the latest on the proposed Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. So do you support regulators allowing this massive transmission line to go in? What questions do you have about the status of the line and what happens next? Join in right now, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. But first, let's look at resettlement figures. 2019 brought some big changes in federal immigration policy, including for refugees. The Trump administration drastically cut the total number of refugees allowed to resettle here in the U.S., and that has, in turn, lowered the number of refugees who are making their homes here in Wisconsin. Our colleagues at Wisconsex took a closer look at the state's refugee resettlement trends and how they compare year over year. Will Cushman is an associate editor at Wisconsex, and he talked with WPR host Keely Baltina.
Let's start with the top line numbers. How many refugees made their home in Wisconsin in 2019?
480, which is just a few more than in 2018 when 472 refugees arrived in the state.
What's context for that, though? Is that consistently what we've seen over the years, or did Wisconsin have fewer or more in recent history?
Right. So this leveling off in 2019 from 2018 is a bit of a pause in a trend since 2016 in a pretty steep plummet. In refugees arriving both in Wisconsin and nationally.
We've seen a lot of changes under the Trump administration as far as how many refugees are let in. Wisconsin isn't saying we're not taking any more refugees. It's just fewer refugees are coming into the U.S., so that's trickling down?
Exactly. The U.S. State Department really coordinates refugee resettlement with resettlement agencies all over the nation. And the State Department follows guidelines, limits that are set by the presidential administration. Previous administrations set quite higher limits, for the most part, on the number of refugees that could be resettled every year. The limit that President Obama set in 2016 was 110,000 refugees. And then when President Trump took office in early 2017, he actually paused the program momentarily and then decided to set the limit at 50,000. And since then, the limit has been decreasing every year. In fact, the limit for 2020, which that fiscal year, so this goes by federal fiscal years, it's a little confusing. The numbers that I'm reporting are calendar year versus the limits that presidents set are for a federal fiscal year, which starts on October 1st. So that's already started for 2020. That limit this year is 18,000, which is a historically low number.
And do we know if Wisconsin's taken in any refugees since October 1st?
I'm not sure. I've talked to a director of a resettlement agency up in the Fox Valleys, World Relief Fox Valley, or the Fox Cities, excuse me. And she said that they have not resettled any refugees since the beginning of the fiscal year. They have plans to resettle three sometime in the coming weeks, but she said it's down precipitously.
Well, we do have 480 refugees who have come to Wisconsin in 2019. Let's talk about those. What do we know about these refugees that have made a new home here?
Right. About eight countries are refugees are from about eight countries, I believe, eight or nine this last year. There's a few from Syria, from Ukraine, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, Somalia. But the vast majority of the refugees are coming from two countries, as has been. It's consistent with previous years, those two countries being Burma, also known as Myanmar, in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and then the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Over 200 refugees have arrived from each of those countries in 2019.
And specifically the Congolese refugees, this is relatively new for Wisconsin.
It is. There were virtually no Congolese refugees as recently as 2013.
And so now they're finding a place. Specifically, where are they going once they come to Wisconsin? Where are the epicenters of places welcoming these refugees?
It's really centered in a few places. Milwaukee continues to be the top destination for refugees in the state, which makes sense. It's the largest city. In particular, Burmese refugees. A lot of them are members of the minority Muslim group, the Rohingya, who have been persecuted in Burma. Most of them are going to the Milwaukee metro area. And then most of the Congolese refugees are going to the Fox Cities. So and primarily Oshkosh, and then this last year, primarily Appleton.
And even though they're taking the most refugees in the state, Milwaukee is actually taking fewer refugees in the last several years?
Yeah, most places, most communities in the state have been taking fewer refugees in the last several years, which mirrors state and national trends. But an interesting thing is the share of refugees going to Milwaukee has been shrinking for the last 5 years. So the overall number of refugees and then the proportion of refugees arriving in the state is also smaller in Milwaukee in 2019 than it was just a few years previously. And a lot of that is because of a growing share of those refugees going to the Fox cities and to a lesser extent to Madison and Dane County.
And do we know why they're going places other than Milwaukee or why refugees settle where they do?
A lot of it is dictated by just the resettlement agencies that are present in a local community. And World Relief, the resettlement agency in the Fox cities, has been really, really busy and active in resettling Congolese refugees. And actually, for the last few years, they've mostly just been reuniting families. So with refugees that arrived initially in 2013, 2014, now their immediate family members are joining them. And so that's what the majority of those new arrivals are.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and we're talking about international refugee communities in Wisconsin. And let's talk a little bit about the state's history with refugee resettlement. What kind of context should we put this year's numbers in?
Yeah, Wisconsin has a long history of refugee resettlement, welcoming refugees. It's one of three states that in the 1970s and early 1980s accepted, resettled tens of thousands of Hmong refugees. So these are refugees from the Vietnam War. They were originally living in Laos, moved to, escaped to Thailand and lived in refugee camps in Thailand, and then hundreds of thousands overall, but tens of thousands arrived in Wisconsin in the 70s and 80s. Wisconsin has been accepting refugees pretty much every year since then. There is a pretty major spike in the early 2000s as the last refugee camps in Thailand that had Hmong refugees living there closed. And so there was a wave of several thousand new Hmong refugees arriving in the early 2000s. And then since the early 2000s, the mix has really become much more diverse in where refugees are coming from. A lot are still coming from Asia, but then also the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa. And it was growing quite a lot, as it was nationally, up until 2016 when things changed.
And you are acknowledging that things have changed. What are you hearing from resettlement agencies when you're talking with people who do this work? How do they see things have changed?
The Trump administration is generally warier of pretty much all things immigration, and that includes the refugee resettlement program. But the director of World Relief, Fox Valley, who I talked to, said that 2019 was actually surprisingly a pretty good year for them. And by good year, I mean they were able to resettle quite a number of refugees. But again, as I mentioned earlier, most of those are family members who are reuniting with refugees who are already living here. And that those family reunifications are a priority for both the UN and the U.S. State Department. And so I think that's why most of that is that's what is happening mostly now.
What are we seeing in communities in Wisconsin? There's some support for resettling refugees here in different parts of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's actually a very new change that's happened now, this kind of like explicit support by government officials, because there was an executive order that President Trump signed in September of last year in 2019, requiring states and quote-unquote localities to provide written consent for refugees to be resettled within their borders or jurisdictions. So what that means is that a state's governor or a county board of supervisors or a mayor has to write a letter saying, I support the resettlement of refugees in my community, or we as a board support that. And so what we're finding in Wisconsin, Governor Evers signed such a letter in December. A whole bunch of communities with significant refugee populations have also done so. A bunch of counties, Brown County, Dane County, Eau Claire County, Calumet, Winnebago, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and then several cities, Madison, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and Green Bay, and Appleton as well. And then there are other local governments that are expected to write those letters still, including Outagamie County, which is where Appleton is.
And are they on deadline?
They are. Yep. That deadline is January 21st. So it all has to happen pretty quickly.
If they want to declare their support for refugees in their communities.
Exactly. Because and if they don't, that is considered that community is off limits to resettlement. So if a governor were to not write that letter, the whole state would be off limits. But that's not the case in Wisconsin.
All right. Will Cushman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And that was WPR host Keely Baltina talking with Will Cushman of WisContext. You can read more about refugee resettlement trends in our state and find Will's story and other items on the topic at wiscontext.org. Coming up, WPR's lacrosse reporter Hope Kerwin joins us to talk about some of her recent reporting. She will get us up to speed on how campuses respond to sexual harassment cases, and she's checked in with farmers on their corn and soybean yields. She's also tracking this shipping bottleneck on the Mississippi River. Do you run a business that's been affected by Mississippi River shipping delays? How much was your business hurt last year? Do you think the government should have done more to speed up the shipping channel? Phone lines are open to you, 800-642-1234. We head to La Crosse right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're zooming in now on news in the western part of our state. Here are some of the things we'll be touching on. Corn and soybean yields and how farmers are doing right now. The status of that proposed Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. And we start with the shipping delays on the Mississippi River. Do you run a business that's been affected by shipping delays? How much did it compromise your business last year? And do you think the government should have done more to speed up the shipping channel? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in now. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she joins us from our studios there. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the weather and shipping on and farmers. A record-breaking amount of water caused major shipping delays on the Mississippi last year. Let's listen to Doug Hazu, president of the Upper Mississippi Waterway Association. That's a shipping trade group.
We've had floods, certainly, in the past and high water. That's not uncommon, but it's usually, you know, two, three weeks and business as usual. And that just really was never the case.
So just how unusual were the river's water levels last year?
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers tracked around 25 trillion gallons of water going through Lock and Dam 10 at Guttenberg, Iowa. That is well above the previous high that was set in 1993. And by comparison, the average is about 12 trillion. So a really large jump in the amount of water we're seeing going through the Mississippi River.
Then, okay, so how does the shipping industry get affected by that rising water?
Yeah, so when we have high water, it basically forces barges to tow fewer forces boats to tow fewer barges. So they could go from a 12 to 15 barge tow to down to about a 9 barge tow in high waters. It also makes some docks inaccessible for these boats. They just don't fit under the spouts to load up whatever commodity that they are shipping up the river. And so it basically forces the shipping industry to kind of rethink their logistics of where they're loading barges and where they're docking them.
And did that bear out in the number of commodities being shipped?
It absolutely did. There was the number of commodities was about 25% lower than the 10-year average shipped on the river this year.
And then you talked with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has the job of dredging the Mississippi River to maintain the navigation channels. How did the water levels affect their work?
Yeah, so when in times of flooding of high waters, it forces a lot more sediment into the waterways. And so the St. Paul District ended up dredging about 1 million cubic yards of dredged material, which is enough to fill Lambeau Field.
Wow.
So a lot of dredged material coming out of the river just in the St. Paul District alone. And so there was also a need to dredge more on the river in our area. But actually, the St. Paul District ended up sending two of their dredges south of of downriver to the St. Louis area and also down to the state of Mississippi because of more serious flooding down there and the need for more dredging there. And so that forced the St. Paul District to actually narrow the navigation channel that they maintain on the river. They're tasked with maintaining a 9-foot depth, but they ended up bringing that more in a more narrow channel so they could just keep up with the pace that was needed.
And a narrow channel, I assume, means less traffic running through that channel.
Yeah, again, that just impacts the shipping industry's logistics, the way they're thinking about shipping, and forces them to have to get a little more creative and, you know, really impacts shipping times on the Mississippi River.
So did you find that the Army Corps of Engineers, that they have enough resources to keep up with the dredging demand?
So the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, they said this was definitely an unusual year for them. Obviously, anytime you have a record high, that's unusual. But, you know, they say they were able to keep pace by narrowing the channel and just really staying on top of things, anticipating where we might see the need for more dredging. Just the number of locations on the river were also impacted. They saw, you know, more locations needing dredging than is typically needed in a summer.
We're catching up with WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Hope Kerwin is with us sharing some of her recent reporting. Do you grow corn or soybean crops in Wisconsin? How was your harvest last year? What issues did you see throughout the year? And what do you hope will be different this year, 2020? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Hope, the weather also wasn't kind to Wisconsin farmers in 2019. You looked at that government data tracking corn and soybean harvests. What did you learn about harvesting last year compared to the past?
Yeah, this was the second slowest harvest pace on record for corn and soybeans this year. You know, crops ended up being about 3 weeks behind the average, and that was pretty consistent from spring all the way to harvest. You know, we saw really wet soils the previous fall heading into winter, and that just really set us up for some really late planting once we saw, you know, snow melting on top of saturated soils, and then just another really high precipitation spring impacted farming that way. So with that delayed planting, that just really set farmers up to continue to be behind almost, you know, all growing season long.
So as you talk to them, they couldn't get into their fields. What were they doing?
Yeah, I mean, it was historically delayed planting, not only in Wisconsin, but really across the Midwest. It was, you know, we saw kind of a record number of prevented planting acres filed through crop insurance. And, you know, when fields are wet, farmers can't get their machinery out because it causes ruts in the fields and really does a lot of damage. And so it's a delicate balance. They really need to wait for those fields to be in prime condition to start doing work. So for a lot of them, it was a waiting game in the spring. And you know, a lot of waiting also come harvest time of waiting for those conditions to be prime as well.
And so if you're so behind schedule with a slow pace of harvest this year, how could that affect this or, you know, next year's crops?
Yeah, so because, you know, crops were delayed and we saw harvest delayed, that really impacted people who do who till their fields in the fall in preparation for the spring. I talk with some crop experts who actually say that more and more farmers are getting away from fall tilling because there's new science that's starting to show that it's not as beneficial as it has been thought in the past. But that does set some people up who prefer to till their fields before planting, and it could impact spring planting. I think a lot of that will also depend on what kind of winter we get.
So last year wasn't all bad for news for farmers. Egg producers set a record high in November. What was behind that?
Yeah. So when I talk to egg producers about this record high set for November, you know, they mentioned that they really feel like the drive for cage-free eggs has actually helped some of this expansion. You know, they pointed out that some of the larger egg producers in our state have really invested in cage-free operations. And so that could be behind this bump we saw, not only in November, but also another record high set the previous month in October. And so, you know, we're definitely seeing egg production kick up a little bit in the state. Wisconsin's not, you know, necessarily a top egg producer, I would say, in the U.S., but we're up there. And, you know, they said that this drive for cage-free eggs from, you know, major food companies, from mayonnaise companies to all the way to McDonald's, you know, they're really driving this demand for cage-free eggs.
So is it market forces that perhaps is starting to drive up egg production here in the state?
Yeah, I definitely would say that drive from, you know, big corporations like McDonald's, mayonnaise companies, you know, they're looking for cage-free eggs because consumers are looking for, you know, those types of products. They see the, you know, the demand from consumers to make maybe what some would say is more, you know, responsible production choices. And so they see this as a market to invest in as a way to attract customers.
Well, for the soybean farmers and the corn farmers, will they need government assistance with in terms of being so behind with their harvest and yields not maybe being what they should be? What will government assistance look like?
Well, we've seen, new forms of government assistance this year and last year in the form of market facilitation payments or trade aid payments going to farmers. We also saw some, obviously prevented planting, what I mentioned earlier. That's a crop insurance program where if farmers can't get their fields planted on schedule, you know, they're able to file for some money through their crop insurance programs. So we've seen that form of government assistance. But you know, at the end of the day, it also might just be farmers, you know, kind of eating the difference of not having as high of yields or as productive as crops as we've seen in previous years.
And you talk with farmers a lot. Are there any egg success stories that you've been reporting on this past year in an otherwise really difficult year?
You know, I think we've seen farmers across the industry having to get creative in times of not only in hard growing years, you know, like we've had this year, but also, you know, the last several years of low prices, you know, kind of across the industry. You know, we've seen a lot of farms having to get creative and cut back expenses and, you know, really just kind of build their resiliency. I think we see a lot more interest from the ag community lately in helping farms build resiliency to low prices, you know, helping farms think about their farm financials and, you know, being smart with their input costs to kind of best maximize their production. And, you know, I think that that's going to continue to be a trend, even though we do see, you know, things like milk prices starting to come up. Mm-hmm. I think farms really recognize they need to, you know, build that resiliency.
We have WPR's reporter in La Crosse as our guide. Hope Kerwin is with us. What do you think of how universities are responding to campus sexual assault misconduct? Should universities be doing more to help victims and hold offenders accountable? What problems do you see in how colleges handle sexual misconduct cases? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with WPR journalist Hope Kerwin here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, we're moving through developments in the western part of our state here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We'll talk about Congressman Ron Kind's reaction to the impeachment inquiry, the status of the massive Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line, and let's start with UW-La Crosse's response to a sexual harassment probe. Here are some questions to weigh in on. What do you think of the proposed massive transmission line through southwestern Wisconsin? How about Congressman Ron Kind's voting in favor of impeachment? Do you support his vote or are you against it? And what do you think of how universities are responding now to campus sexual misconduct? Should they be doing more to help victims and help offenders be accountable? Join in 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Hope Kerwin stays with us from our La Crosse studios. Hope, you've been reporting on the UW La Crosse's response to sexual harassment after the student reported being harassed by the college's art department chair. Here's that student, Casey Bean, at a recent news conference.
My story the first time that I came forward with it to UWL was exactly the same as the second time. So that just shows that there's something broken within the UWL system.
So let's back up here. What did Casey Bean report to the university, and how did the school respond?
Yeah, this all started back in September when Bean made a public Facebook post claiming that at the time, an unnamed art professor, who we now know as Joel Elgin, had sexually harassed her as a freshman. And she said that she had come forward to UWL in the previous March and reported that sexual harassment. But, you know, she claims that university officials did not communicate with her over the course of that investigation that summer, and that she had to be the one to reach out to the university to find out the results of that investigation. And she really just felt that the UWL's response was inadequate, that they didn't do enough to protect her and protect other students from this, you know, this harasser.
And the arts department chair, Joel Elgin, had retired while he was under investigation. How has he responded to these allegations?
Yeah, so UWL Chancellor Joe Gao first announced that Joel Elgin was retiring in December as this investigation into him, I would say the second investigation that happened after Casey Bean made that public Facebook post in September. It was announced that Elgin was retiring. Later, his attorney issued a statement on his behalf saying that Elgin had cooperated with university, investigators and had planned to meet with the chancellor to talk about the results of that investigation and also face a faculty review until a university attorney reminded him that some of his retirement benefits were at risk the university were to take action against him, he could lose some of those retirement benefits. You know, Elgin claims that those were worth thousands of dollars in retirement and that he didn't want to risk that that benefit to himself and to his family. And so that was why he retired. But, you know, he really maintained that these allegations were false and kind of warned other faculty as well that the university would not protect them against, you know, potentially false allegations.
And the chancellor said there's going to be a forum to answer questions on this. Has that happened?
That has not happened yet. Chancellor Gao said when he announced that Joe Elgin was retiring, you know, Gao said that he hoped to eventually release the results of that second investigation into Elgin and host a campus forum to talk about the investigation, this issue, and really hear student and faculty's complaints or concerns.
Are those concerns, especially among the students?
Yeah, so I think what we've heard from Bean and from other students is a need for more transparency on behalf of the university when it comes to responding to sexual harassment. They feel, you know, I've heard the sentiment that they feel the university kind of tried to keep this under wraps and, didn't want to release a lot of information about what was happening. And they just really felt that the university's initial response to Bean's complaint was inadequate and did not do enough to protect her and other students.
We're talking with WPR's La Crosse reporter Hope Kerwin. She's bringing us up to speed on some of her recent reporting in the western part of the state. Hope, let's switch to another really big story you've been covering, and that's the proposed $500 million Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. Opponents of the transmission line filed a lawsuit to block it. Here's their lawyer, Howard Lerner.
They should not have been hearing that case. And we believe that's just a matter of law, it's a matter of good policy, and it's a matter of common sense.
So give us some context here. What is Lerner saying about Wisconsin's Public Service Commission?
Yeah, so, Lerner's organization, they filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. They are claiming that the Public Service Commission should not have approved the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. And they were also challenging—
Which was approved back in September.
Correct. Yeah. And they are challenging also the decision by two commissioners on the PSC to not recuse themselves from that case. So the environmental groups claim that PSC Chair Rebecca Cameron Vock and Commissioner Mike Hipsch, they should have recused themselves because they had connections to utility groups supporting the project. Vock had previously served as a regulatory counsel for Wheat Energies, which is a parent company of one of the owners of this line. Hipsch is currently a member of an advisory committee for another utility group kind of advocating for the Cardinal Hickory Creek line. And so, they really felt like those commissioners should recuse themselves from the decision, and therefore the decision should not stand.
So what happens next in this case?
Yeah, so, this obviously will go before a federal court and continue through that process. We've also seen, these same groups file a lawsuit in state court as well on the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. And so, this will obviously play out in the courts. So far, the Public Service Commission, while they have not commented on this litigation because they don't comment on pending litigation, they have kind of pointed back to their decision in September where the commission dismissed this motion that was filed by these two environmental groups on the same issue. The commission found that the claims had no merit, and they also questioned the timing of their motion. Given that the commission had already partially approved the project, and so they really felt like this was kind of a Hail Mary last minute motion to try to stop that decision.
You've also been keeping an eye on Iowa and what they're doing, because this line would stretch from Madison to Dubuque. What is the status of getting this through in Iowa?
So the Iowa Utilities Board did hold some public meetings in December in Dubuque, which is where this line would connect, as they're kind of considering the project. And so, because this line stretches across state lines, that Utilities Board will also need to approve this project.
Well, you've also been doing some reporting on the ice and ice fishing. How does it look out there in the western part of the state?
Yeah, so on the western side of the state where I'm at, ice fishing is really popular on the Mississippi River. But, I talked to a conservation warden with the DNR, and, she said that the ice is really kind of not what we normally would see as far as depth or thickness. She mentioned that a lot of the, just precipitation we've been getting recently has actually raised water levels. And in some areas, that water's above the ice now. And so it's really just kind of an unusual year. And ice conditions, as she described them, can be a little unpredictable. We're also seeing some kind of abnormal or unpredictable conditions in central and northern Wisconsin as well, where we see a lot of snow on the ground. That really heavy snowpack, creates kind of an insulating layer in the ice. And according to, fishing guides I talked to there, and, the ice just really doesn't grow that depth that it normally does. And it also creates kind of a slushy layer, and it's not really fun to be on.
Well, Hope, thanks so much for joining us, getting
thanks
us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We've been recapping some of her recent stories on shipping and farms, sexual harassment, ice fishing, and she joined us from our studios there in La Crosse. Just ahead, we take a look at a driving course in Wisconsin that lets you practice your winter driving skills. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.